Florida has a program that buys back homes in areas that are likely to be hit hardest by climate change. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. But the plan is to buy homes in areas that are at greatest risk for floods and climate change, like those hit by Hurricane Irma in the Florida Keys.
Even if the house wasn't completely destroyed, it wasn't may not be livable. I know our staff went from 37 to 23 after the storm.
Also, thousands of low-income families face a significant expense not covered by federal programs. Diapers. We'll meet a nonprofit leading a massive diaper drive. And since the Trump administration tightened travel opportunities to Cuba, there's a fear of losing touch. But a new photo exhibit might help us reconnect with some of Cuba's old communities. Finally, an art exhibit in Key West that looks at family, loss, and superstition. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. There are people who will not leave the Florida Keys, even after the damage they suffered from Hurricane Irma. But others are ready to move on, and that'll mean changes for home ownership, businesses, and the environment. One of the realities of climate change is that some areas will be more at risk of flooding and damage than others, thus making living there expensive. The state is using money from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development to buy out homes and return those areas to their natural design. How much can this help? Well, earlier today, we spoke with Alex Harris, environment reporter for the Miami Herald. When did the state home buyback program actually start?
So this state buyback program got started pretty recently, only a couple of weeks ago. Initially, the state only had a month open for homeowners to reach out to their communities and apply for this program. But recently, after some pushback, they pushed it the date all the way back to October 1st. So now we have a couple more months where people can reach out to their various communities and apply for this program.
How much of this is directly, because of Irma?
It is all Irma. So this money comes from HUD at the state level, the Housing and Urban Development. It's federal money. So this federal money is our disaster relief. They collectively gave Florida $1.8 billion from HUD alone. That's not talking about FEMA money. That's not talking about a lot of other sources of money that come in after a hurricane. So this HUD money is mostly for rebuilding people's houses. That's the vast majority of the money. It's also for repairing. It's also for bringing things up to code. It's also for buying and funding new affordable housing. But a $75 million pot of it, which is one of the smaller pots of it, but is a significant pot, is for allowing people to sell their homes to their state or city using this federal money so that people can demolish the property, turn it back to nature, and leave.
What's the strategy? Is it just specific areas the state is tackling? Or are they saying anybody in the state, if you want to, have us buy back your home, we can?
So there's a map on the website where it shows counties most affected by Hurricane Irma are the ones they are looking for specifically. But there's an extra special pot of money just for Monroe County. So of that 75, $10 million is specifically for Monroe County. That doesn't mean that Monroe can only use that $10 million. They can use more than that $10 million if they want to. But that's what's set aside because a lot of the focus is on the hardest hit areas from Hurricane Irma, which is the Florida Keys, of course.
You spoke with the homeowner, Kathy Reitzel. Tell us a little bit about her.
Kathy's been living in this home in Big Pine Key for a good amount of years, and she really loves it. She loves the big yard where she has all this gorgeous landscaping and trees. She loves getting to know her neighbors. She loved being down the street from work. But Hurricane Irma took all of that away from her, and she had had repeated floods previously, and she'd had issues with rain and storms and hurricanes. And after Irma, where it totally destroyed her house, totally destroyed her yard, all those beautiful trees are down. She started thinking about it and thought, maybe this isn't where I want to stay long term because I don't know if I can do another hurricane.
She'd been living there for a while.
Yeah, she'd gone through several storms already.
And so what was it about Irma compared to the other storms that she said, okay, that's it, I'm done?
Well, this was probably the strongest storm she'd ever gone through, but also she lives on the avenues in Big Pine, which is a really, really vulnerable spot that Irma just really ground right through. And she says now when she looks at the end of her street, some of the homes that were harmed by Irma are totally gone. So there's only one house left between her and the water, and all the trees are gone. So she doesn't think that the neighborhood is strong enough to survive another really big storm without some more serious damage. But really for her, the biggest concern is financial. So like a lot of people in Big Pine, which is the heart of affordable housing in the Florida Keys, which was really one of the hardest hit areas by the hurricane, they may sit on land that's incredibly valuable. but their homes were kind of old, and now that they're destroyed, they don't have that cash on hand to rebuild their homes all the way up to new code, which could include going up a story or two, having all new hurricane windows, hurricane doors.
That's one of the challenges, is new codes, people
right.
meeting the new codes. Was it hard for her, though, to make this decision?
It was. She and I talked a little bit about it, and she said, you know, whenever she thinks about the fact that if she does sell her home for this program, which she's hoping to do, she said she looks out in her street in the mornings and she thinks of, like, wow, I really love this neighborhood and I'm sad I'm going to have to leave. But that thought is always followed immediately by, but wait, I know I have to leave. It's important. It's important for me to get away from all of these hurricanes. So her plan is to move somewhere where hurricanes can't reach her.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Alex Harris. The state of Florida has begun a buyback home program in hurricane and flood-prone areas. And you can see her story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Also, tell us on Facebook, do you think there are parts of the state that are no longer livable and perhaps we should consider buying back homes and turning it back to nature? You know, we went down to the Keys around the same time last year and talked to residents. One person we talked to was Doug Mader. He's a veterinarian. He lost his home twice in hurricanes, and he spoke with us about the challenges of getting his employees back after Hurricane Irma.
Even if the house wasn't completely destroyed, may not be livable. I know our staff went from 37 to 23 after the storm, and it's been impossible to hire anybody because there's no housing. I'm offering jobs. We're paying extremely, extremely well compared to national averages, but even if they come down here, there's no place for them to live.
How often do you hear stories like that?
So it's actually funny. I've spoken with Mader, too, in the past, and I think he's a really good representation of what we see a lot in the Keys, which is that the real impact of Hurricane Irma is in the affordability of living down there. You can rebuild a house. You can rebuild it to code, but you need quite a bit of money to do that. And all of these homes that got destroyed, if you live there and you're a homeowner, you get a discount. You get a little bit more financial help from FEMA. You get a little more help from financing, from your insurance, a little easier. If you don't live there, you don't get that same, you get a little bit less help if it's a second home or a vacation home. And that hurts renters who their property doesn't get as much financial aid in coming back up to functional status. So rents go up. And that's something that even the former mayor of Monroe County talked about. And he said, you know, I'm going to have to raise the rent on my rental properties because it costs so much money for me to put them back together. So the rental properties are going up. There's homes that are destroyed. The hotels are really expensive. You can't short-term live there. There's a crunch supply of housing already in the Keys, and this just made the problem more dire.
How is the state deciding on these applications? Because the application deadline, again, as you said, got pushed back a little bit.
Yes. So the new application deadline to apply to sell your home through the state is October 1st. And the state has specifically said they're looking for low and moderate income homes in communities that are most at risk to repetitive flood. In the Keys, I know Monroe told me they're looking at homes that are at risk from sea level rise. They're also looking statewide at homes with elderly people, with younger children, people with disabilities. So basically the populations that would have the most difficulty selling these homes themselves. So that's what the state really wants to step in and be that part of that equation that doesn't maybe necessarily exist as well in the private market.
Do you have any sense of how many people have applied for this?
I've heard dozens in the Keys, and when I went to one of the Miami-Dade County meetings, I saw about 8 or 10 people had already signed up in one of the meetings. So there's not a sense yet, and I think the extended deadline will give us a higher number than we originally saw.
Have you heard from anybody in Miami-Dade County, on this idea that maybe some point in the future we've got to consider buying people's homes because certain neighborhoods are just going to be at greater risk?
So that's kind of a touchy subject. Most people don't really want to talk about it because there's such an emotional connection. Who wants to talk about the idea that this neighborhood you live in, you love, you grew up in, is going to be gone forever? That's a terrible thing to talk about. But a lot of scientists say that there will eventually be a day when sea levels rise enough that regular flooding makes some areas of the state and of this county uninhabitable. I talked to South Miami Mayor Philip Stoddard a little bit about this because he is one of the elected officials who's most willing to talk about this issue. And he said, yes, he sees these buyouts as a form of retreat. It's a start of, or as some experts like to call it, managed relocation, which is a friendlier term. But yes, it's going to be smart for us to move back from the coastline, especially if we want to live here a little bit longer and not have to deal with flooding as often.
It's understandable that people don't want to talk about that idea of having to leave because of flooding and climate change. But, I mean, you live in the beach, right?
Right.
So does anybody talk about it?
So it's actually a pretty common topic of conversation in jokes, at least, of people I know that live there. But really, it's one of those things where it's people don't really want to look at or think about it. So they don't want to think about it in terms of 30 or 40 years from now. They're focused more on the day-to-day living. Miami Beach is working very, very hard as a municipality to dispel the idea that you can't live here in 30 to 40 years with a lot of their programs and a lot of their messaging they get out. And they're definitely ahead of the curve when it comes to investing in infrastructure to make the city livable for longer. So there's no talk of retreat from the municipal level, though, I will say, in Miami Beach.
And that was Alex Harris, environment reporter for the Miami Herald. You can read more of her reporting on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And if you want to hear more about the Florida Keys and the most important issues to sea life there, join us for a special town hall event happening this Thursday from the studios of Key West. We're going to be speaking with politicians, marine experts, and advocates about the dangers facing the coral reefs, sea turtles, and more. Just go to WLRN.org for more information. Well, still to come, a program that helps mothers struggling to get diapers. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Thousands of children returned to school in South Florida this week and last week. The youngest of those children, heading to daycare and kindergarten with their parents, are required to bring specific supplies. Now, I'm not talking about pencils or crayons and paper. I'm talking about diapers. For thousands of low-income families across the region, diapers are a major financial burden. On average, a child can go through $80 to $100 worth of diapers in a month. Gabriela Rojas is the executive director of the Miami Diaper Bank. It's a nonprofit organization that raises funds to purchase diapers and then distribute them to homeless shelters, foster care, and low-income families in the state. And she joins me now in studio. You like to go by Gabby. Gabby, thank you so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Hi, Liz. Thank you so much for having us. Really excited and grateful to be here today.
The story behind Miami Diaper Bank, this is fascinating. My understanding is it was started by a 13-year-old boy.
Yes, it was actually started by, he was 13 years old at the time. He needed a project for his bar mitzvah, and he happened to hear on a radio station like this about diaper need. So he decided to collect the diapers, and when he went to distribute them to what he thought was a already established Miami Diaper Bank, he realized there was none. So he decided with his dad to generate a 501c3 for Miami Diaper Bank, what is now.
And how did you get involved?
I actually started with them when my son was 6 months. I started volunteering, doing some marketing work for them. Fast forward a year later, and they offered me their first full-time staff position, and I gracefully accepted it. After having my first experience delivering diapers and being a struggling mom myself, I knew that diaper need was a real issue, that it's in here in South Florida. So I wanted to make the biggest difference I could. So now it's been about 4 years since I've been with them, and now I'm their first executive director. So very happy to be part of this great organization.
Something that's interesting about this is that, again, there are a lot of different federal programs to get assistance.
Correct.
For different things, but nothing for diapers.
Correct.
Right?
Correct, yeah. So if you have food stamps or WIC, unfortunately, they're not covered. Diapers are not covered by those programs. If you do have cash assistance, you can purchase them, but that's also 14% of the budget that you already have to purchase light bills and your food and things like that. So it's a big burden on low-income families who are living under the federal poverty line.
In the time you've been doing this, you've met people who've been through a lot of challenges. But tell me a little bit about what you tend to hear from families as to the burden of just getting diapers, what that's like.
Yeah, so it's actually reported that 1 in 3 American families are not able to purchase diapers, so they either have to choose between food or diapers for their babies. And diapers is a basic necessity when you think about it. We like to say that babies need 3 things, food, shelter, and diapers, obviously besides love. But if you don't have one of those things, it really puts a strain on the family and the moms who are just trying to provide the best possible life they can for their babies.
How do they do it then?
So we are, that's why we're here. So we partner with over 35 organizations in South Florida. So we're actually serving six counties currently, everything from Palm Beach all the way down to Monroe with a focus on Miami-Dade. And we try to provide as many diapers as we can for these families to make sure that their babies stay clean, dry, and healthy. And just, you know, we're trying to do our best that we can with fundings, with diaper drives in the community, and just really pushing this forward.
Do you remember the first time that you were volunteering or working with this group and you were out delivering diapers? What was that like?
It was amazing. I this is one of my favorite parts of, my job, is delivering the diapers. I remember the very first time we made a drop-off to Cope Center North, which is a middle school and high school of choice here in South Florida that provides in-house daycare for teenage and expecting mothers so they can finish their high school diploma. And I walked in with a big cart of diapers, and I just remember seeing this young lady's face really light up and tell me, "Oh my God, you guys brought diapers." Like, being a mom myself, just seeing her face light up for such a basic necessity, I just love putting a smile on another mother's face to make sure, you know, they feel like they're doing the best that they can to improve their lives, to improve their baby's lives, and get out of the cycle of poverty.
What's it been like? There was a story you were telling me. We were talking just before the segment about a young woman, very young woman.
Yes, she was from Cope.
Yeah, she was from that program.
Yeah, and she was a junior at the time. And I remember her just kind of lighting up and jumping up and down saying, "Oh my God, we have diapers. Oh my God, we have diapers." And I'm like, "Am I Santa right now?" It kind of felt that way. And she was like, "Yeah, it's just so great to see you guys come because I know that my baby will have clean diapers and I don't have to worry about it once I go home." So we try to fill the pantry for Cope as much as possible. If they have any leftovers, they'll send some home with the girls so their babies can come back to school with no diaper rashes and no other health issues.
How many diapers monthly is your group distributing?
So monthly, it really varies. Since the beginning of the year until about June, we've already distributed 7,000 alone. We've served 7,000 children, and we have donated over 1.9 million diapers. We're trying to hit our 2 million diaper mark by September 29th because we just know that there's so many families that need our help, and we just want the community to come together and help us achieve that goal.
I'm talking with Gabriela Rojas, Executive Director of the Miami Diaper Bank, and the bank is in the midst right now of a diaper drive, hoping to collect funds for 2 million diapers ahead of September 28th. They're collecting for the start of the school year, of course, and in preparation for hurricane season. We are already in the middle of that, actually. Getting diapers before the school year, this is really important for some families. And my understanding is that if you're dropping off your child at a daycare, you got to bring diapers.
Correct.
They don't provide.
They do not provide diapers. You have to bring a minimum of 8 diapers per day. So, you know, if a family who is low income is struggling to purchase diapers, they can't send their kid to daycare and therefore they can't go to work. And it becomes this really big cycle of them not being able to get out of poverty and just struggling to make sure that their kids are clean and provide education for their child. So it's something so simple.
What was it like a couple years ago after Hurricane Irma?
So we loved, it was a big problem for us in South Florida, but we loved the fact that the community came together. We had a campaign after the Hurricane Irma relief where we raised so much funds that we were able to expand from Miami-Dade and Broward to the other counties that we're serving now. We distribute majority of those diapers in the Keys. For Hurricane Irma alone, for that campaign, it was about 1 million diapers, and we served about 25,000 families struggling with diaper need. It was a little bit over a year and a half that we helped families and organizations. So it was great. And ever since then, we were also able to send some diapers to Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. And recently, after Hurricane Michael, we were also able to send over 85,000 diapers up to the Panhandle.
You know, right now, as we talked about, there's no federal program that really helps. There is a law that recently passed in Florida that goes into effect in January, and it removes the tax on diapers. How much is that going to help?
That's actually going to help a lot. We were lucky enough to have Senator Brooke introduce Bill 60. And
Senator
Lauren
Brooke, yeah.
Lauren Brooke, correct. And so we sent in a letter and to approved to have the Senate approve this, and it went into effect. And on the letter, we stated that about children's wear about 50 diapers a week or so with a tax exempt of 6%, that would allow a parent to buy an additional 12 diapers. So just even something as little as taxes can help a family a lot.
Where are you in the drive? This 2 million, the 2 million diaper drive.
We are 1,925,000 diapers, so we're really, really close, and we are hopeful that we're going to reach that goal.
You know what? As we move forward, I was just curious. I mean, talking about how parents, what parents can do. Has there ever been a conversation too about reusable diapers?
Yes, we get that question a lot, cloth diapering, mm-hmm. But unfortunately the demographic that we're serving either don't have their own washer and dryer or are, you know, in a homeless situation. So unfortunately cleaning...
it's a tough option
for some
people.
Cleaning them, it's expensive. Cleaning them, it's really tough if you don't have a washer and a dryer. And laundromats here in South Florida do not allow you to wash your cloth diapers in them. So because of the demographic that we're serving, we try to stay in with disposable diapers.
Talking again with Gabriela Rojas, Executive Director of the Miami Diaper Bank. They are collecting the funds for the 2 million diapers, as she said, they're almost there.
We're collecting diapers and funds.
And funds. They're almost at the 2 million diapers again for the September 28th deadline. And you can learn more about their drive on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Gabby, thank you so much and best of luck.
Thank you so much. And again, thank you for having us. We want to make sure that the community comes together. Diaper drives, funds. We actually have an Amazon wish list where they can purchase diapers directly and send them to our offices. Every single diaper counts towards this goal, and every single baby should have clean diapers.
Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, what is Afro-Caribbean swagger? Photographer Carl Joost is opening an exhibit on Cuba's nostalgia. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. What do we know about life in Cuban neighborhoods? If you are from Cuba or if you have family there and have been able to travel back, you know how most of the island is trapped in an era from decades past. That life has been captured in a new exhibition of photos called Cuba, Paradise Lost in Nostalgia. The photos in the exhibition come from a collection of award-winning photographers. They were collected during a trip to Havana just before the Trump administration put tighter restrictions on travel to the communist island. We spoke with the lead photographer and the curator of the exhibition, Miami Herald photographer Carl Joost, and we started the conversation about misconceptions people have about the island nation.
I think people get caught up in nostalgia. It's complex, and the use of nostalgia is a tool to prop up ideas, prop up propaganda. It's really interesting because you go to Cuba now, at least when I visited, nostalgia is everywhere. You have, you know, pictures of Che, you have pictures of the revolution and the various iconic images that came about after 1959. And at the same breath, you have the old Esso trademarks and you have all these Americana pre-revolution. And it's this awkward space where the government is using that era to attract tourists. But at the same time, you know, you're just trying to hold the bottle shut and opening it slightly every 2 seconds. The genie is out.
You know, I was looking through the photographs, and I mean, you have some black and whites, but most of them are color.
Right.
Brilliant colors in the clothes, the buildings, the cars. It even seemed like the sky had this brilliance to it. I don't know. It's just, and I wondered though, because it's interesting, like, but yet you have. It's a communist nation. There's a poverty. It's this weird contrast. Were you trying to find that?
Yeah. You know, Cuba speaks for itself. I didn't give any of the photographers or photojournalists any specific aim or any specific objective. So I have this color called Cuban blue. And it's, if you notice the cars, and it's reflecting the sky, it's in the buildings, and it's this repetitive calmness in the midst of sometimes can be very chaotic if you live there. And I think that you know, you see kids with cell phones. You do see improvements because Cubans, I think, by nature, entrepreneurs. And I think it's one of the factors that helped build Miami.
You know, you talk about that nostalgia. And so, I mean, again, you look at these pictures and we see like they're stuck in an era.
Right.
And I wondered, I mean, look, we see that, or at least I'm thinking of like this guy, an outsider. I look at that and I'm like, I mean, that looks interesting, but it also looks kind of sad. Like they're stuck there. Do Cubans there believe they're stuck there?
I think Cubans, the most Cubans that I've spoken to and had some type of correspondence with, I think they would say they're here and they're making the best of it in spite of, you know, 50 plus years of embargo. It started opening up a little bit. And when I was there, there was Americans everywhere. There was this exchange. There was this conversation. Every time I've been to Cuba since the special period, which dates back early, late 80s to 1999, every time I've been back, it has moved in a certain direction. Now, for some people, they may say, well, kind of loss is charm. But I don't find anything charming about being poor. I don't find anything charming about being persecuted. I don't find anything charming when your freedoms are restricted. But what I do find, and I wouldn't use the word charming, what I do find very exciting is the resiliency. Because I see that same resiliency in Cuba that I see in Haiti, or I see in Mexico, or I see in Brazil.
When you were out there, I wondered how Cubans responded to you with your camera.
Because I'm doing this book, Havana, Haiti, Two Cultures, One Community, I went with some type of permission of the cultural department. Okay. So I went. I didn't go underground. I didn't want to go underground because I wanted to be honest in my approach. When I approached someone, I wanted to be honest. This is not about politics. It's about humanity, right? And trying to form a connection, a bridge to what. Like I always tell my friends, what the pain in Haiti is the same pain in Havana, that there is pain is pain. And I'm trying to connect to what draws us together, right? So I needed to do that with an honest approach. So what I found that when I was talking to people and talking to the person in the street who is doing their daily hustle, because Cubans know how to hustle, and it's not a dance step, it's a lifestyle. They can hustle.
When you have to go through the government, basically, so you're not going underground. What does that mean? Does that mean that they're watching over you or they're telling you what you can and can't do?
No, we had a taxi service. We had certain things already pre-set up, but I was not censored in any way because I didn't go to Cuba with any specific goal or idea or agenda. I went there to see myself, and I found myself in so many different people. And I went there to bring a little bit of me back to Miami. So the pictures that you're seeing now is not pictures of just Cubans. It's pictures of you, pictures of me. If life was slightly more different, that's how we probably would look like. So that's the connection.
I love how you said you're talking about that hustle. You mentioned that. And, you know, we've discussed that on the program a lot. And is it a Latino thing? Is it a Caribbean thing? Where's that hustle come from?
I think it's a Caribbean, poor, struggling, you know, underserved, looking for freedom thing. Because when light is taken away from you, the power of a match is so much more powerful. So that's the only way I could explain it. I am a product. I am an immigrant who left the country under persecution. So I get it. My mom is Cuban. She would talk about Cuba. She'd talk about Santiago, talk about Havana. And so I really, and when I arrived in Miami out of New York, my core friends were all Cubans. You know, and this pride like Haitians that we have in our nostalgia. You know, you're in the car and someone say, well, when I was in Cuba, you know, I was a doctor. That was the stories I was hearing when I first came there. Or when I was in Cuba, you know, I was a psychologist. And they hold on to the best of themselves. And that's why they are able to do so much great things in Miami. Because though it had a painful experience, and it's difficult to be displaced, for them to understand that they have achieved heights, that the height can be obtained in a more freer society, it opens up a lot of doors to them. So I have to give it to my Cuban brothers and sisters. I think we share the same imagination.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald photographer, Carl Joost. He's the lead photographer behind the new group exhibition, Cuba, Paradise Lost in Nostalgia, on display now at the Iris Photo Collective Art Space in Little Haiti. You can see some of the photos of the exhibition on our social media. Find us at WLRN Sundial. I wanted to pick out two photos to ask you about, because these, for me anyway, they jumped out a lot. One of them is this gentleman who's standing there. He's dressed in white.
Oh, yeah.
White pants, the white vest. Tell me a little bit about who this guy was.
That picture was shot by Jeffrey Allen Salter, who's an extremely talented and gifted photographer and former photojournalist. We're walking down towards to we're going to go grab some lunch, and we came upon this beautiful wall that looked like a wall you would see in Beirut. Looked like it was bullet ridden, you know. And we're looking at it and said, man, that's a really dope wall. And at the corner of my eye, we both spot this gentleman walking in a Caribbean Afrocentric swagger. And he's walking towards us. And we had an agreement, right? First sight, first get. So if he sees something first, I got to put down my camera, right? So he goes, I got this one, right? So he pulls up his camera, and he doesn't speak much Spanish. But I mean, my Spanish is about maybe two levels higher than his, right? So I ask him, I pull him aside and say, I tell him in Spanish, you know, like, take your picture. Give me a moment. I like your style. He spoke a little broken English. We started laughing. And then Jeffrey said, just stay right there. And to me, he embodies the best of, I think, of the Cuban spirit.
I wonder, what is Afro-Cuban swagger?
Oh, man, it has a rhythm, a cadence to it, you know? It's like a movement. It's like a left to the right, left to the right. It's almost like he's dancing with the wind. It was beautiful. I'm telling you. It was no joke. If I had a video, I'd have videotaped it.
Now I see this man, because, again, the picture, you know, you see that attitude, but now I'm picturing him walking.
Man, it's like watching a jaguar, you know, just like a dark jaguar walking down with a sense of authority, with a sense of purpose.
In contrast, the other photo I wanted to talk to you about was it was an elderly person in a bed. And there was another person, I'd imagine a relative, watching over them.
Yes, this is Carol Guzzi's photo essay called Mama. And Mama is an insular view of the life of a lot of Cubans, as because the subsidies of there's no longer Russian subsidies, and Cuba really relies on the tourist dollars to support some of the social initiatives. A lot of the elderly are being taken care of, though. I mean, Cubans and like Caribbean people do take care of their grandparents. But this young woman is now left to take care of for her mom. And she cannot walk. Her feet is deformed. And she has some issues. And the photo essay kind of covers a couple of days of her life. And the mother becomes Cuba's past. And the daughter becomes Cuba's present. And then this relationship back and forth, the mother is somewhat docile, almost like a doll. And she is somewhat has to surrender her life because she wants to. She loves her mom. But you see what that love means, the sacrifice. It symbolizes a lot of the Cuban expatriates. They see their country and the love they have for their country. They want to care for their country. But it's so difficult in these circumstances. And I think that's what I think she caught very well.
There's something I've always found fascinating about photographers is how you get shots. And I understand, I can understand how there are times when things are just happening very quickly and you've got to be, if you're there, you got it. But some of them seem so personal. And I wonder how you get so close that people would let you that close to take something that, we've seen this. I've seen this with my abuela in bed and my mother taking care of her. How do you get those kind of pictures? How do you do that?
I think you have to embed yourself not only physically, but emotionally. For images to actually work, it has to become a portal. And in order to get that image or a group of images to facilitate as a conduit, proximity is everything. You have to be in it, but not about it.
There's another picture. There's a picture of what looks like a very official building, and then there's the word Cuba, the sign Cuba. And then I see it from the distance.
And that car is coming by?
And a car is coming by. And then it seems like I'm looking at that same Cuba sign, but up close at a later time of day.
Right.
It's the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is fascinating to me because it gives me two different views of something, and I feel something different with each one. But tell me, what is that spot?
It's right on the Malecón, and it's right by the National Hotel. The National Hotel used to be the hotel. It's like the Fontainebleau of Havana, right? This is where back in, you know, it's where all the rich connected kind of some gangsters, you know, the Wheeler dealers. This is where they hang out, like the Fontainebleau. And what I love about that picture is because it really has a really postcard feel to it. It has all the elements that attract you to Cuba. It has the beautiful blue sky, has a wonderful architecture, has this reference to nostalgia. And if you look way in a corner, the streets looks empty, and it's a little guy walking. And it's almost perfect. It's the illusion within the truth. And I thought that was very impactful because it kind of encapsulated the whole project. And then you look at the sun setting, and you see the letters, they're not as bright. They're somewhat, it'll almost seem like they're faded. That speaks to memory, right? When you have a memory that you could recall some details, but everything seemed kind of behind a frosted window. So you're looking at this beautiful sunset, which is the subject. But as the subject flows, you see the sign that says Cuba. It almost seems like it has retired. And there's a weight to it, right? One is very light, one's very heavy.
Which speaks back to your point of patience. Because you have to come back and get that second picture the right way.
Yeah, because you have to speak, right? Images is what words and phrases and sentences and stories are to writers. It's a visual language, right?
Yeah.
Everybody's bilingual. You speak the visual language first, and then you get the written language second, the spoken language. But the best pictures are not reflective. They're more images that you go through. Young audience won't get this, but you ever went through a line of clothes just freshly put on a line and you run through it? That's the same thing.
Hanging the clothes out in the lines outside.
And you go run right through it. The breeze picks it up and you have this process. And that's the joy. That's the art of making imagery. I mean, imagery is not the product. It's the process where realness meets human expression.
That was Miami Herald photographer Carl Joost. He is one of a group of photographers in an exhibit called Cuba, Paradise Lost in Nostalgia. It runs from August 24th through October 10th at the newly installed Iris Photo Collective Art Space in Little Haiti. Well, still to come, we're going to meet a Key West artist whose work looks at family, loss, and superstition. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, a collection of wildly bold and colorful paintings dealing with themes like family, loss, and faith are now on display at the Bryan Gallery at the Custom House in Key West. They are by painter and sculptor Olga Manasalvas. She was born in New York but was heavily influenced by her Ecuadorian family's faith and superstitions. She then moved to Madrid and went to art school there. And all of that is depicted in her latest exhibit, The Restless Eye, The Visions of Olga Manasalvas, which is on display now through September 30th. I sat down with her yesterday and we talked about some of her pieces. So Olga, I wanted to ask you about the influences you had starting all the way back when you were a kid, and whether you had art at home or it was what you learned in school. And obviously, you know, later in life going to Madrid to school. How would you describe how your style was shaped and what your style is?
When I was a child, my parents made sure to take us to museums in New York City as often as possible. So I saw a lot of art growing up. Also, I didn't speak for quite a few years. And when I'd hear a word, in my head, it was an object. I think I started drawing that way. For example, Articles of Impeachment, which is one of my paintings was made during the Clinton debacle. And Articles of Impeachment to me meant things that folks use for torturing people. So that's why I put them in the painting, because to me, I still think that way when I hear words, pictures appear in my mind. I wanted to express what I thought the Articles of Impeachment meant, something to physical to torture someone with. And so that's why you see the figures preparing to torture this being who's busy doing something he ought not to be doing.
You know, when I looked at some of your work, I think about some of the different artists that I've studied over the years. Who were the influences, you know, the artistic influences for you?
When I was a kid, it was Gauguin for the color, the sun, the light, especially being brought up in New York City where it was always gray. The German Expressionists, Max Beckmann, Egon Schiele, people that really used figurative work to express a lot of emotion through color and through gesture.
So I want to dive into this exhibition. It's called Restless Eye. You named it. Why? What does that represent?
Actually, I titled it The Restless Eye because I look at everything, and if it strikes me, as in myths, dreams, magic, especially magic realism, if a figure represents something spiritual to me, I will try and make that image. I am a restless, my mind is restless. I get bored if I do one thing or pay attention to one thing at a time. I like to look around and gather impressions from things that I see or people that I talk to.
Going through your pieces, and I want to point out a couple of them, part of the themes that I see is family. One of the pieces is called The Yaman, and this is fascinating. Okay, so I see a figure on a bed, and then I see four other people on that bed as well. I see two women with their backs to this figure who's lying there, a third figure holding the feet on her lap, again, of this figure who is lying there. And a fourth figure really stands out. She's bright. She's light-skinned. She's bright in color of what she's wearing. Her hair is fiery. And she's on the telephone. And she's looking at that figure lying in the bed. Tell me what I'm looking at.
What you are looking at is the sisters of the figure on the bed. He died suddenly. So they all went to the house, dressed him, washed him. And the woman on the bed is one of the family members that is very important in this kind of ritual. And what she's doing is she's calling the rest of the family to inform them that this man has died. So that's why I painted her that way. She is a firecracker. You know, she's always in the thick of things. When you have an emergency, you go to this particular person.
And then I see it looks like the spirit of this man leaving the room.
Yes, and the cat underneath, the cat is the only being that notices the soul leaving through the open window.
Again, the artwork, the piece is called The Yaman. It translates in English to They Are Calling You. And there are a lot of pieces that you have that have these connections to death, to faith, to superstitions. Why are you drawn to these themes? What's fascinating about them for you?
The unseen has always drawn me, and also growing up with stories of family members who have passed away, but you can still feel them in our homes. You can, for example, I have a great aunt whose daughter passed away tragically, and she was crying and praying the rosary, and all of a sudden she hears this huge boom, and her window completely shattered. And I think that it was my cousin who came back to tell Mom, okay, cut it out. I'm free. That's enough.
Wow. You know what? I'm curious about your upbringing and, you know, I guess the spirituality in the house. What was it like?
Oh, that was fascinating as a little girl for me, because my grandmother would have little saints on her bureau with lit candles, And she would tell me stories of, if you pray to this one, you'll get that. If you pray to that one, you'll get this other thing. And she told me stories of fantasmas and what'll happen to you if you're a bad girl and things like that. I loved it all. And I had an aunt who would take me to these horrible movies. I was little. That had crucifixions of Christ, you know, the whole bloody, gory stuff. So instead of scaring me, it just fascinated me. So I'm still attracted to that kind of dark symbolism.
I'm talking with Olga Manosalvas. She's an Ecuadorian painter and sculptor who is currently based in the Florida Keys. Now, she's been doing this work for more than 40 years. Her most recent exhibition, The Restless Eye, The Visions of Olga Manosalvas, is on display now through September 30th at the Bryan Gallery at the Custom House, which is part of the Key West Art and Historical Society. It's a collection of wildly bold and colorful renditions dealing with themes like family, loss, and faith. And you can find more information about the exhibit and see photos on our website at WLRN.org. You know, again, talking about this family theme, we look at another piece, Family Circle, and this one's really interesting in this sense. The other one, there was a separation of the characters. Even though they were all together in a room, they felt separate. In this one, I mean, everybody is on top of everybody in this very tight space. It gets a little claustrophobic, almost so close that it's like no one looks happy. And I'm wondering, what are you trying to capture here?
That's those moments when you have been way too long with your family in a situation. So, yes, I meant to express claustrophobia. Every one of them is preoccupied with a certain thing. For example, the woman that's clutching the man's pant leg is trying to make him stop bothering the child, and the child is busy screaming at the older man. The young man with the crown on his head is desperate to shut his kid up, and there's a little figure on the bottom that is the figure that is quiet and observing all of this and is miserable.
Was that your experience with your family?
I've seen it, let's put it that way.
So, Olga, you went to Madrid, and you went to a very prestigious art institute. Why?
My family was separated when I was a kid, and part of us went to Spain. So I studied there for a year at the Escuela de Bellas Artes, and then we came back to New York. It was very good training, because when the person who was responsible for letting students in looked at my work, my portfolio, they said, well, here in your country, they teach backwards. They teach you to be, expressive. Here, you have to learn from the classics. And I needed that, because I only drew things that came out of my head and very flat figures. And they taught me how to represent figures on canvas and paper in three dimensions, shading, et cetera.
There's a very different way of approaching art in Europe compared to the United States.
Very much so. It's much slower, because they say you have to, you have to learn how to ride a bicycle before you can go out there on a highway, for example.
You know, my understanding is that you haven't shown any of your work really to the public in quite a while, right?
That is correct. I submerge quite a bit. I'm a bit of a recluse, and I have, about 20 years ago, I had big shows. I had one in Ecuador and in New York City, et cetera, and it really took a toll on me. So I decided, you know what, I'm just going to make things because I have to. That's the way my life is. So I guess that's why I hid for 20 years, but I just kept making things.
And then you decided, well, now is the time to come back and show everybody.
No, actually, someone asked. No one's really bothered to ask me before, or if they have, I decided, I'm not really ready yet. But someone asked at the correct time, because my storage space was overflowing, so I had to get the stuff out there.
How has life in Key West influenced your work?
Oh my gosh, the Cuban families and their stories. The voodoo, the Santeria in particular, This place is just spiritually an amalgam of all kinds of ghosts, if you will, of the past and the present. And so being that kind of person, I was just, you know, crazy for it because I met so many very interesting people, and the artists here are unbelievable.
How do you view the future? Is it about continuing to grow and change, or just producing what you know?
I have changed a bit in my style, so I think I'm going to keep following that route.
Do you see yourself opening yourself up to expressing yourself more to the public, or do you think, well, here's an exhibit, and then I'll go back to my studio and do my thing again and hide for a while?
Well, the latter would be ideal for me, but the powers that be, those people that want to push me out there, I'm never going to say no. So, yes, I assume that I will continue to be more open.
That was Olga Manosalvas. Her latest exhibition, The Restless Eye, The Visions of Olga Manosalvas, is on display now through September 30th in Key West. Find more information about the exhibit on our website at WLRN.org. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, August 20th. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to look at a company called JPay. It's handling electronic video services and emails for prisons. But does that mean that they're also reducing face-to-face communication with people? They're out of Miramar. We're going to learn more about them tomorrow. Plus, a new film called Peanut Butter Falcon is out in theaters this weekend, and we're going to meet the star who's from Boynton Beach. All of that coming up tomorrow on the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.